WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I will be your guide for the next 2 hours, or close to 2 hours. We have a great list of guests who will be joining us, starting off with David Tirk. David is with the Beacon Hill Institute, and we're going to talk a little bit about the millionaire's tax, more so as to why this is not necessarily a good idea, but it's going to be on the ballot in 2022, so stay tuned for that. Following David, we will speak with Andrew Sullivan and Peter Brown. Both of them are Pembroke businessmen who are going to talk to us a little bit about tomorrow night's town meeting, the annual town meeting, and probably one of the prime conversations will be about the community center. We'll get the ins on the community center, so you'll be better informed come time for the gavel to start the meeting. Hour number two, we speak with State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Now, the auditor joins us. We're going to talk about a couple of different things. Two reports that have been published recently. One was on the Massachusetts State Lottery Commission and BAMSI, the Brockton Area Multi-Service Incorporated. We'll talk with her about that, and then we'll close things out. This segment that we did like 5 weeks ago with Mike Joshua, you know him, host of the Americanorama. He's also the president of the Soul Homestead Education Center. Don't know if you know this or not, but I'm sure John Shea will tell you because Almost Famous will be hosting this live music show that'll be at the Soul Homestead this coming Saturday. So we're going to rebroadcast and share the details on that to get the word out. One quick note as we get ready before we go to traffic real quick. Upcoming fundraiser. This is a bike run. It's actually to honor a veteran who has since passed. And this individual was a big supporter of the Boys and Girls Club in Brockton. This is being brought to you by the TJG Memorial Fund. Next Sunday, there's actually going to be a bike run. It's a motorcycle run that's going to be starting from the old Kmart parking lot that's on Main Street, 2001 Main Street in Brockton. And it'll conclude at the Brockton VFW on North Quincy Street. This is going to be from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Tickets are on sale for $20, and the proceeds are going to be going to the Boys and Girls Club of Brockton. I did look for details regarding a website or whatever. Best I can tell you is if you want more information, I would reach out to the event coordinator. His name is Randy Delgado, and his email is randydelgado25@gmail.com if you want more information about this event. Right now, time for us to step aside just for a moment, but it's only for traffic, and we'll be right back. Traffic being brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop, online at brennansmokeshopma.com. Locations are in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now in Hudson, New Hampshire.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The expressway southbound slow from Mass Ave to Southampton Street, and again from Bryant Ave to the split. Northbound's tied up from Adams Street to Freeport Street. Route 3 South is busy from the expressway to Union Street. Northbound, you're on the brakes before and after Derby Street. And Route 24 South, that's busy from 93 to the Horse Bridge. This report is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Prime members save this week at Whole Foods Market on animal welfare certified bone-in beef rib steaks for $11.99 a pound through June 22nd while supplies last. Learn more on the Whole Foods Market app. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
The 10th annual on the 11th year Goma's Mini Bike Massacre featuring Inverter. Saturday, June 26th, the pandemic came. We are the survivors. This year's theme is the undead.
Riders must dress the theme. Mini bikes and go-karts, 212cc or smaller, pull starts only. Waivers must be signed by all participants by 10 a.m. Rider registration is $30, spectators $20.
Goma's Mini Bike Massacre, the undead. 45 North Tower Road, Wareham, June 26th.
Join Goma's Mini Bike Massacre on Old School Facebook. Brought to you in part by Brennan Smoke Shop. Brennan Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts and soon New Hampshire. Brennan Smoke Shop, customers must be 21 years of age or older and proper ID is required.
Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for the first segment of Monday Night Talk. We have a special segment. This segment, we're going to talk a little bit about a piece of legislation called the Millionaire's Tax. Joining us is David Chirk. He is the president of the Beacon Hill Institute, and he also recently wrote an op-ed piece in Commonwealth Magazine talking about this piece of legislation, the proposed legislation. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. Happy to be here.
So first and foremost, what kind of things does the Beacon Hill Institute study and take a look at? And what triggers your organization to look at certain pieces of legislation or political items?
We do economic research studies. We try to combine a readable presentation with a sophisticated analysis. We've been doing this for 30 years. We were the first part of that period. We were at Suffolk University, and for the last 4.5 years, we've been on our own, operating as an independent 501c3 public charity. We do a lot of work on tax policy. We did some work on the Trump tax cut of 2017, and a lot more work on tax policy within the various states. To help in that work, we developed a computer model, call it STAMP, State Tax Analysis Modeling Program, that uses algorithms to estimate the effect of tax changes on the economy of the state wherever we're using the model. And we decided to take this on because this is right in our bailiwick. This is a Massachusetts issue. We're a Massachusetts operation. I did testify on this a few years ago in its earlier incarnation. That was in 2016, but we updated the estimate to work for 2023 when the millionaire's tax would go into effect if it's approved by the voters.
So, talk, if you will, share with me the details as you understand them. Again, that is in a part of your organization's detailed study. At least share the highlights as to what this particular tax will look to do initially.
Sure. Well, the whole idea is pretty simple. You make up to $1 million in income under this amendment to the Constitution. And by the way, it requires an amendment to the Constitution because the Constitution currently requires income to be taxed at a flat rate. That rate is currently 5%. But to start over, if you make $1 million in taxable income, you pay 5% on that $1 million. If you make $2 million, you pay 5% on the first million and 9% on the second million. So what the amendment would do is add a 4% surcharge to the income tax as it applies to income over $1 million. This, by the way, the legislature's, there have been attempts, numerous attempts in the past to get this done. This one seems more likely to succeed. In the past, it was a kind of open-ended constitutional amendment, and I think the voters said to themselves, well, gee, I'm going to end up paying more in taxes under this, and they voted it down. But this time, the proponents cleverly limited the impact to a very small fraction of the taxpayers.
Now, where is it in the process? Because I believe my understanding is that this could eventually, this will eventually appear on the ballot in 2022, in November, right?
That's right. In the process, we're at the stage where all that's left is for it to be put on the ballot in 2022. The legislature had to vote favorably twice. It did that just a few days ago, for the second time. And so now it's slated to show up on the ballot. And if it's accepted by the voters, it will go into effect on January 1st, 2023.
What are the ramifications if this is something that is passed by the voters? How harmful will this be to the Commonwealth's economy?
I think there are two answers to that question. The first answer is it will impose a small but measurable damage to the Massachusetts economy, and we measure that damage. And the second part of the answer is that it opens the door to further amendments of the Constitution, which would get us to have a graduated rate, much like New York or California, which would, I think, be ruinous for the state economy. But that's in the future. Right now, we modeled the existing proposal, and we determined that the first year, in effect, it would destroy 4,400 jobs. It would cause 4,400 people living in households where somebody's employed in the household to move out of the state. It would destroy 9,329 private sector jobs, reduce investment by $7 million, cause real disposable income to fall by $963 million, and reduce production by $431 million. Now, those are negative effects that would be imposed on the state economy because of the negative effect of the tax on the willingness of people to work and save in Massachusetts.
So, David, I guess the next question I would have to ask, I'm sure that this has been pitched. I'm sure that there's some kind of a bell curve reason why it's to the point that it's at is because legislators feel as though there's going to be X amount of dollars generated by the so-called tax. What stands to be gained, or what are they saying stands to be gained if, in fact, this passes?
Well, the word that's been going around based on estimates by the Department of Revenue is that it's going to raise $2 billion in taxes for the first year out. But because it will shrink the state economy rather measurably, we estimate the increased revenues to be only about $1.2 billion, substantially less than what the proponents are promising and are counting on. When the proponents put this together, they did get an estimate of what the tax increase would do in terms of raising new revenue, but they've made no attempt to estimate how that tax increase would cause shrinkage in the economy and therefore would cause the revenue take to be less than what they were predicting.
Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we're privileged to be speaking with the president, the Beacon Hill Institute, David Tierk. And David is talking to me about the millionaire's tax, as he has actually written a couple of different pieces about it. One of them most recently, an op-ed piece in Commonwealth Magazine. My biggest fear is we're coming out of a pandemic right now. And I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about this. We're coming out of a pandemic. Who knows where our economy is going to be in the next couple of years? And, you know, and how will something like this have an issue when it comes to economic development, especially in communities that are trying to rebound from a global pandemic?
Well, it's never a good idea in an economic downturn, even when you're recovering from a downturn, to raise taxes. So your point is well taken. Fortunately for the Commonwealth, the tax increase wouldn't go into effect until January 23, at which point, arguably, the economy would have recovered to its pre-pandemic level. So that may not be a telling consideration after all. But the point is this. Massachusetts is, by every measure that we can find, a highly competitive state. It competes well for workers, for capital, and it ranks number one in our list of states, that in our ranking of states according to their competitiveness. But raising taxes does not improve competitiveness. And that's witnessed by the fact that this tax increase would drive 4,000 some working households out of the state. And the state, remember, is already losing residents, just in the normal course of things. It's not losing residents at the clip of California or New York, but it is losing residents. People would very much like to play golf all year round. And this is going to increase the incentive to get out of here and to make money elsewhere rather than pay this additional tax.
Now, I don't know if the Beacon Hill Institute had a chance to look into other states that might have instituted it. Are there any other states, at least in the Northeast corridor, that are also looking at this as a way to generate revenue for their annual budgets?
Well, I think that every state except Massachusetts and New Hampshire in the Northeast corridor has a graduated income tax. I'm not sure of that. Most states do. I think about 30 out of the 50 states or so have a graduated tax. So insofar as that tax is graduated, which means insofar as the tax rate is higher on high-income people than on low-income people, that is a disincentive to continue living in that state. And I know that Connecticut recently imposed an extra tax and tried to tax millionaires. I think New Jersey did, where they're going after so-called millionaires. And I think the jury may be out on those taxes, but there is evidence these taxes have in fact driven people out of the state.
This is just a mere ballpark question here, or a shot in the dark, but is there still a chance that this could fall short from making it on the ballot, or is it all but assured to be
absolutely assured to be on the ballot? Okay. It will be. The question is whether the voters will approve it or not. Now, you know, there will be a massive effort on both sides to either defeat it or get it passed. The unions are going to throw a ton of money into it, particularly the teachers' union, because the teachers' union stands to benefit. We haven't talked about a feature of this amendment that I should mention.
We do.
The amendment presumably dedicates all the new revenue raised by this tax to roads and education. So it's apple pie. It's doing all the right things in terms of voter sentiment. In our article, in our report, we argue that this may not be a really sensible idea. First of all, the amendment cannot guarantee another $1 or $2 billion in new spending on roads and education, because those activities are already funded from other sources, and it would be easy for the legislature to cut back on the revenue from these other sources, even as it dedicates the revenue from this amendment to those activities. Not that I think that the legislature is going to ever cut back on education or infrastructure spending, but it is an empty promise to say you can assure that revenues allocated by this amendment will in fact add to existing spending on those activities. As far as education spending is concerned, we already spend arguably as much as we ever should on education. We're very high in terms of our maybe sixth or seventh in terms of per pupil spending on education in this state. And as for transportation, Massachusetts is notoriously unable to spend efficiently on transportation now. I don't know why that is, but it ranks very low in terms of the efficiency of its spending and very high in terms of what it already spends. So that goes to the spending side of this discussion.
Well, and that's interesting, knowing that, just prior to the pandemic, I would say maybe a year prior, that, the Baker-Polito administration did put forth an opportunity educational piece that's supposed to be over, I want to say, 5 to 7 years, and it's going to help those gateway communities that are, you know, I believe that it's kind of a revamp of the ed reform of 93, that you know, they're already going to be spending a significant amount of money. Do we know that 100% of this money is going to go towards transportation infrastructure and education, or are they just saying we're going to put money towards it?
Well, the legislature could determine how much money the new tax is bringing in. And then it could, then the legislature has to decide, well, how much will we spend on education and infrastructure this year? Sure. So really what this amendment does to actual spending on education and infrastructure is undeterminable because money is fungible. It goes into the general fund, and the legislature can do whatever it wants with the money in the general fund. And there's no guarantee that passing this is going to add to spending on those activities. That is in face of the fact that the already arguably spends as much as it ever should, especially on education.
And again, if you are just tuning in, we're speaking with David Tierk. He is the president of the Beacon Hill Institute. We talked a little bit about a study that was done, a detailed study in regards to the so-called millionaire's tax that is going to be heading to the state ballot in 2022. David, I guess I would ask you I'm one of those proponents. I like seeing both sides trying to tell this story, whether it's through advertising on TV or on the radio or getting on talk shows like mine and trying to be a proponent for their side of an argument like that. Are you looking forward to something like that, to see here how the two sides tackle this ballot question?
Well, we hope to be part of the discussion, that's for sure. I am discouraged by the prospect that it's going to pass. I think that having a flat rate income tax is one of the strengths that Massachusetts offers in terms of its competitiveness with other states. There's no doubt in my mind that two things are true. First of all, by creating a graduated income tax will reduce the competitiveness of the state. And the second thing is that this is not the end of the story. In a couple of years, the unions and all the other advocates are going to come back and want to amend the Constitution again to make it the income tax rate even more progressive than they're making it now. And this will not stop until we look like California or New York, and therefore until we find ourselves driving people out of the state in droves like those states are doing.
David, anything that we've overlooked in this, in at least telling the story of the analysis of this particular tax, this ballot question that's coming to voters in 2022?
The only thing I can think of is that it should be particularly embarrassing to the proponents that the state is right now flush with tax revenue. Revenues are coming in at a rate that exceeds any expectation, including our own. We have a $46 billion budget already, which Baker wants to pass and doesn't need to raise taxes in order to fund it, and doesn't need to take a lot of money out of the rainy day fund. It only draws slightly on the rainy day fund to fund that budget. So we have a $46 billion budget and tax revenues coming in at record rate. And now we want to tack on another $2 billion in taxes. Why are we going to do that? First of all, another $2 billion isn't going to accomplish that much. Second, it's not going to be another $2 billion. It's only going to be another $1.2 billion. And third, we can't be sure that $1.2 billion will be used as it's intended to be used.
David, I want to thank you so much for being my guest. And I hope to have you on for more discussions just like this in the future.
Be happy to do it.
He is David Tierk. He is the president of the Beacon Hill Institute. We talk a little bit about the millionaire's tax. I'm sure we'll probably have David back on to talk about it as 2022 draws closer. We're going to step aside. That concludes this first segment. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Tiny of Tiny Sons Glass. If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield.
Ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny and Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing. Give me that ding.
So give me that ding. Tiny and Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
Hey, it's John Shea here from Almost Famous Radio, introducing you to independent bands and musicians from across New England every Tuesday night, 8 to 10, brought to you by Tiny and Sons Glass. Coming up tomorrow night, another full night of music. We'll chat with Mike Joshua and Peter Brown about the Soul Homestead Farm Middleborough Summer Concert Series, and we'll be joined on the Tiny stage by Sarah Blacker. That's tomorrow, 8 to 10, right here on 95.9 WATD and 95.9WATD.com.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we are back for yet another segment here on Monday Night Talk. And not sure if some of you folks are aware or not, especially in the fantastic town of Pembroke, but tomorrow night is the annual town meeting. And I believe that one of the prime or one of the top conversations that will be taking place on the floor of town meeting will be about a project that I think has been in the works for some time. And when I say some time, I'm not talking like a year or two. I think it's been something that has been talked about for many years. Joining us right now to talk about why you should consider voting for a community center at town meeting tomorrow night, we have Peter Brown. Of course, you know him from Tiny and Sons Glass, vice chair of the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce. And then we have Andrew Sullivan. He's a local business owner as well, president and owner of Protecto Wire. Gentlemen, welcome to Monday Night Talk. Well, Peter, welcome back. Andrew, a hearty welcome to the radio program.
Thank you for having me.
You got it. And, well, Peter, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. There should be more fanfare. Let's not forget, Peter is a premium and proud sponsor of Monday Night Talk.
That is correct.
And we appreciate your support. And we appreciate both of you for talking about something that can be very instrumental for the community moving forward, if it is not only approved by a vote tomorrow night, but also, let's not forget that later this week, Saturday, that you have to vote for it during the annual town election. Is that correct, Peter?
That's correct. Tomorrow night is very important.
Andrew, if you will, give me your thoughts on what made you so interested and so supportive of wanting to have a community center built?
Well, gosh, it's quite a long story. I'll try to abbreviate as best I can, but I've been in Pembroke for 56 years now, soon to be 57. And, you know, as a child growing up, on High Street, we would scurry through the backwoods up to the existing community center site. And, you know, I just spent my youth growing up around the building we're talking about today. So, you know, I've been around it, and I've been in town for many, many years. And it was probably about 5 years ago, I was my daughter and I were signed up for town basketball and went into the facility, which I hadn't been in many years. And I was really just dismayed to see the state, the condition of the building. And I started inquiring what was going on with it, and approached the select board. And I had learned there had been several committees over the years, one in 2006 and one in 2011, that studied the grounds and what to do with it. And they appointed me chair to start another committee to revisit it and study it. And we did that over 3 years that brought us to this point today.
There are some who feel that us coming out of a pandemic should not be so quick to want to move forward with a project like this. What would you say to those people, Andrew?
Well, we've all been affected by this terribly, and it's just such a breath of fresh air to be looking at the other side of it as we start to climb out of it. And I think this is the kind of project we can really wrap our arms around with and celebrate post-COVID. And it's just the timing. I think things are aligned as far as costs and needs, and bond rates in particular are historic low rates. There's been a lot of talk about construction cost materials have escalated, but there's actually there was a new report in the Wall Street Journal the other day, and lumber prices are falling fast. And futures have declined 24 of the last 16 days. So we are starting to see a correction in some construction material costs. And there's been another phenomenon that's happened. We've worked closely. Bargman, Hendry, and Archetype is the firm that the town allocated monies for a phase one study. So really, they're the experts behind all the work. Our committee is made up of 7 volunteers, but the architects have really been quarterbacking this for us. They've built over 25 community centers in the state of Mass, so they really know what's going on. And they've been going to bid on projects. There's been, 15 months of no activity with COVID. So contractors are very aggressively bidding municipal work, and they're finding factually bids are coming in very low on projects right now. So if we're able to capitalize on this now, we're actually ahead of the curve for municipal projects that have been postponed and will start to ramp up again.
Peter, I would ask you what do you feel are some of the things that are being distributed for in regards to information that have caught your attention and that you feel is important to at least sharing with a larger audience who may not be aware of some of the positives to building a new community center?
Well, one of the biggest things is that if you drive through downtown and just look at the rec center that's there, it's an eyesore. And the biggest thing with the town as far as moving into the future is that the downtown process, both state and federal, to get grants, you have to show that you're doing some sort of revitalization of the downtown. And when you go into the center, the rec center is one of the biggest eyesores there is, and it needs to be addressed. And there's people out there that think that we could, repair it, rebuild it, restructure it. And we've already gone through that whole process at least 5 times since 2000. And the realization is it needs to be replaced. And one of the biggest things as far as businesses go is that it helps the downtown. When you get downtown revitalization and get people interested in downtown, you make it easier to access, especially the amenities and for the elderly and the youth. It draws people to town to buy homes.
Peter, what would you say, other than being a gathering place, what are some of the other positive attributes to building a new community center?
Well, as we saw in COVID, the biggest issue we had was with schooling. When schools were closed and we're doing home schooling from home, the biggest part and problem that people had was they still had to go to work. There has to be somewhere for the kids to go. And that's where the rec center comes into play. On the elderly aspect of it, it's going to be a community center for the elderly where they can use it for a pickleball, meeting space, all of the above. Veterans Administration is also going to be there. And there's also going to be some sort of business aspect to it. So, and in the town green. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we do in the center between the parades, the Memorial Day parades, the Arts Festival in August. All sorts of things that come into play when that is revitalized.
You're just tuning in. We're speaking with two local businessmen, both of them very passionate about building a new community center. We've Peter Brown, not only a president of Tiny and Sons Glass, but he's the vice chairman of the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce, and also is he has roles in other Chamber of Commerce, a big proponent of community, as is Andrew. Andrew, a big proponent of community, president and owner of Protecto Wire. Andrew, you know, the most important thing, while the kids and some folks are like, wow, this is great, a new space, a lot of the folks who are watching their wallets and their spending are going to say, well, at what cost is this project going to come to me, whether it's my tax bill and or, you know, as to that much money that is coming out of my wallet?
Well, you know, the time is right cost-wise because, you know, the bond rate is one of the biggest factors. At sub 2%, these are historic low bond rates. An increase of half a point in the bond rate drives the overall cost of this project over $1 million. So, you know, the time is right there. As I alluded to earlier, you know, the bidding process is, you know, the time's right for that as well. We've estimated the cost for the average household resident at about $130 a year. This is a debt exclusion. It's not an override. This would go away after the term of the loan. So that, you know, that works out to about $10 a month. We've broken it down to less than 36 cents a day. And this is worst case scenario. There's contingencies built into it, over $1 million in owner's contingencies. And another factor here is grants at the state and federal level. We've identified over three or four grants that align themselves well with this project. Representative Cutler and State Senator Susan Moran both are fully behind this project and ready to go to bat to help us at the state level. So once this hopefully gets approved at town meeting tomorrow night and on the election day this following Saturday, we can then go to the state and really go hard for these grants that should reduce those overall numbers down. We think there's as much as $2 million in grants available for this project.
And I'm glad that you actually mentioned it because it was on my notes. A lot of folks don't understand what the difference. You could say it's an override, right? A Prop 2.5 override. But the key word you said is debt exclusion. Because what happens after so many, depending on how it's bonded out, that comes off the books. And at times, towards the tail end of whatever that debt exclusion is, I believe that it tends to, that the amount that you normally see tends to drop off. I think that's important fact to mention. I will ask you this, though. What are some of the other things that opponents of this project are saying that maybe you've heard, but you want to take a moment to provide insight to?
Well, there's a lot of talk about other needs in town, for sure. Our infrastructure townwide is in need of addressing. We've been needing a master plan overall for what's a long-term master plan for the town of Pembroke. That's in the works currently as well. So the public safety aspect, police and fire both need new facilities. They just like the community center, are working out of very old buildings that need to be updated. So there's a committee being formed, and that's studying the public safety building opportunities, and there are plans to get that committee up and running. And you know, they're probably 2 years out from a viable plan for a public center, public safety building. Our building, our plans are shovel ready. We're ready to do this now. You know, the town manager, select board, and advisory committee are all fully behind this. They've studied it with us. These are our town leaders. The time to do this is now. Let's get this going. It will be a catalyst in downtown Pembroke. And in a couple years, we'll be able to tackle the public safety building. There is debt coming off the books from the school that are identified, so we don't think it'll be much more of a taxed impact for a public safety building. So we can do it all, and if it's thought out properly, you know, we are ready to go. It is so overdue to tackle this community center project. The existing building was built in 1938. It is in disrepair. It is such a sad state. 30 acres in the middle of our town. We have a really well vetted out plan here that's been studied by everyone over 3 years. It's been a very transparent process. So we're ready to go. We just want the residents to get a chance to vote on it, let their voices be heard, and hopefully we can move forward and really get Pembroke going in a good direction here.
Peter, we're about ready to wrap up our conversation here, but is there anything that anything we have not mentioned during this conversation, but you feel is the best way to punctuate the end of this long sentence that has been the discussion about the community center?
I'm going to segue what Andrew said, is that this is shovel ready. And Andrew has spent a lot of his personal time and personal money into getting this ready to go. And we're people with the public safety aspect of it. We're all for it. We agree with everything that they're saying. We're actually forming the committee to help process. But if we can get this going, get this voted in and this started, this brings attention to Pembroke. This helps Pembroke get grants, get money, and entice people to invest in Pembroke. And this will help us in the future projects that Pembroke has. So it's a no-brainer to vote for this tomorrow night and Saturday.
I'll ask you each, and if you could just give me kind of a, I'm asking probably for the impossible. It's almost like when WATD does a political forum and we do the lightning round. And so it's kind of almost like a sub lightning round where you might have one to two sentences here. In your opinion, why is community forever, Peter?
Well, it was what my father used to always say, was like Howard Johnson's had 57 flavors of ice cream. And this is what it's all about, is we have all these different people that need to be taken care of and they need to be included. And that's what community is all about.
Stay with you, Andrew. This is a Monday Night Talk lightning round question. Why is community forever, in your opinion?
Well, community is forever. Buildings are not. And this 1938-4 old school building, it's time to replace it. It needs to be, you know, there's remediation to happen there, and our town deserves better. Our seniors deserve better, in particular, over 4,000 seniors over the age of 65 working out of a very small council on aging building. The growing senior population need to come out of isolation, and they need to be interactive in a great welcoming facility.
Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for joining me and at least sharing this information on the eve of town meeting. Peter, was this something you wanted to mention, or are we kind of, is our business done here for the evening?
If people want to see what other towns are doing, go to Duxbury, go to Marshfield, go to Hanson, go to Scituate. And those towns are way ahead of Pembroke right now, and we need people to focus on Pembroke.
Excellent. Again, we have been joined by two passionate businessmen, community members, Andrew Sullivan, president and owner of Protecto Wire, Peter Brown, Tiny and Sons Glass, vice chair of the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce. Gentlemen, the best of luck, not only tomorrow night, but if all is successful on the floor town meeting, Let's hope that the vote on Saturday basically will make this a done deal. So best of luck, gentlemen, and best of luck to the town of Pembroke.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you for having us.
You got it. We're going to step aside. That concludes the first hour of Monday Night Talk. When we come back, we got a great guest coming up. State Auditor Suzanne Bump is joining us. And we talk about a couple of audits that she's recently done. One of them done on the Massachusetts State Lottery Commission. That's coming up in just a few moments. Right here on 95.9 WATD.
WATD FM Marshfield. WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
We all had a little trouble social distancing from. Here's a clue. About 6 feet tall, has handles, and is cold inside. That's right, our refrigerators. And our waistlines have suffered. However, Skechers would like to help you get back on track with our incredible Go Walk footwear. Because once you put on Skechers Go Walks, they're so comfortable you'll be inspired to get out there and start walking. Skechers is a comfort technology company, and Go Walks are fully loaded with all the comfort and performance innovations you need. They're incredibly lightweight and breathable with features like air-cooled Goga Mat insoles and bouncy foam bottoms for extra cushioning. And Go Walk footwear come in all the fits you love, like stretch fit, wide fit, relaxed fit, and arch fit with podiatrist-certified arch support. Plus, you'll look great with so many stylish options to choose from, including easy slip-ons and comfy lace-ups. And they're even machine washable. It's time you distance yourself from that fridge. Get out there and start Go Walking. Find the number one walking footwear in the world, Skechers Go Walk, for men and women at Skechers.com, a Skechers store, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
The People's Truth, a show dedicated to bringing communities together and keeping the truth alive. Join your host, me, Benny Rabbi, as we talk with businesses, organizations, and people around New England and the world in search of the People's Truth. Join us tonight at 9 p.m. on 95.9 WATD.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Hour number two of Monday Night Talk. And we start off the second hour with a special guest. Actually, it's an extended conversation. Normally when we have the auditor on, it's usually at the beginning of the show. It's a smaller segment. But joining us is State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Auditor, thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be with you again, Kevin.
You know, I want to make sure we got a good, meaty conversation ahead of us, multiple topics. And I'm a believer of always trying to start out a conversation on the right foot. And I think it's warranted to talk a little bit about something that your office actually has been bestowed an award, a special projects award provided or given by the National State Auditors Association. I believe that the award was given because of the report that was done on the police and training accountability. What does it mean to receive such an honor and recognition for your office?
Well, the State Auditors Association is the one that, first of all, conducts the peer reviews of all the state auditors' offices around the country in order to ensure that we are meeting the standards that are set by the Government Accountability Office. But in addition to that, it serves as a training vehicle for all of us who are in government auditing at the state and local levels, because we are required to receive certain number of continuing education credits in the course of the year. It serves as a networking function. And then it also does have what, if you will, a contest every year. Awards recognition for a variety of different kinds of work that state auditors produce in the course of a year. There's a forensic audit category, a small audit, and small being measured by the number of hours devoted to it, category, a large audit category, and then there's a special projects category. And we had previously won, actually, in one of the audit categories, but this time we won in the special projects category. And it was a report that came out not from our audit unit, but rather our Division of Local Mandates. We've talked many times about local mandates, Kevin. You know, those requirements passed down to cities and towns by the state, and we judge whether state should be paying for a certain thing or the local taxpayers should. And in this case, we're actually looking, started out by looking at the costs that municipalities were bearing for municipal police training, not the initial training of police officers, but the ongoing training that's required of municipal police officers. We have the highest requirement in the country, in Massachusetts, of 40 hours. But we found that many municipalities were not able to provide 40 hours worth of training to their police officers for budgetary reasons. The state was contributing, frankly, minimally to police training, while it was falling to local taxpayers to do so. But in the course of looking at that issue and naturally talking to a lot of police officers and chiefs and others involved with law enforcement, we started looking at the issue of police accountability. And one of the problems that we saw was, in addition to not having an enforcement mechanism for ensuring there were 40 hours of training, we also found that there was an inability on the part of police chiefs to know what disciplinary records were of someone who might want to move from one police department to another, and just a lack of training standards. And that report that we released at the end of 2019 came to figure prominently in the police reform debate and legislation that ultimately was passed into law at the end of 2020. And so it was for that work that we were recognized.
So when did you find out that you were nominated? Or what's the process that you find out? And, you know, that you have been nominated and your peers have recognized the work of your office?
Well, the work, we all submit your examples of our work in various categories. I happened this year to sit on the small performance audit award committee. Sorry. And believe me, there are some amazing submissions that get submitted by my peers across the country. And we really use these to learn from one another. This is a great vehicle for enhancing our own sense of what's possible within our respective offices. And so there were always multiple candidates. I don't remember exactly how many candidates there were for the special projects. I think that there were 8 or 10 in this category, and we were notified in May that at the annual conference of state auditors that just occurred at the beginning of June, that we were winning in that category. So we're very excited about that, and got the opportunity at the conference then to present, to do a presentation on the report.
Well, congratulations to you and your office on the hard work and on the prestigious award that was bestowed upon you.
Thank you.
Great way to start out.
Thanks.
You know, the favorite part of our conversations that you and I have is the work that your office does, especially when it conducts an audit provides insight on their findings and even recommendations to remedy the issues. One of the two reports that you and I are going to discuss today is about the Massachusetts State Lottery Commission, looking at its agents, reconciliation reports, and preventative ways that family members of the lottery employees are not claiming prizes or cashing in winning tickets. Right. What led to an audit like this?
Well, the lottery is one of those agencies that we look at on a pretty regular basis. When we had last audited the agency, which goes back five or so, maybe more years ago, we found that there were a number of problems with their, principally with their oversight of their agents. Those are the folks that sell the lottery tickets to you at your local convenience store, and also of the way they were handling tickets. And so naturally, when we went back this time, we wanted to see if they had made any improvements in the areas where we pointed out that they really weren't conforming, not just to best practices, but they weren't conforming to their own written standards or the law, for that matter. And we found that there really has been a lot of improvement there, but there still is room for further improvement. So you had mentioned that records checks was one of the findings. All the lottery agents are required to go through not just an initial background check, but continuing background checks, particularly with regard to criminal offenses that could indicate a propensity to embezzle or steal or otherwise cheat, and they had been really quite far behind in doing those regular checks. They were able, even during our audit, to put into operation some new software, which is allowing them to do an even better job and clear up the backlog that they had. It's important, obviously, that their agents be able to show their personal integrity if they're going to be handling these the very valuable prizes that are represented by the tickets that they're selling. So that was an area where they have made considerable progress, and we were really glad to see that. They still have a ways to go in completely reconciling the books and the inventories of agents who retire or get terminated or transfer their license or what have you. But even there, they had shown considerable progress that had been made after we had pointed out that they were deficient in this particular area. And then one of the last thing was that, of course, if you're a lottery agent, if you are a lottery employee, you and your family members are prohibited from participating in the lottery. You can't buy tickets. You can't claim prizes. And so the lottery, when they have a winner, something more substantial than a scratch ticket, runs through a screening process to ensure that the person claiming a prize was actually legally entitled to buy the ticket in the first place. And when we did our data match, when we ran their numbers against the addresses that were given, we found that there were some three or four dozen individuals whose reported addresses and identities really needed to be checked out further. Their own system hadn't caught these, these that for further examination. So we pointed that out to them. They, in their response to the audit, which is, you know, and their response to the audit is contained in the final audit report, indicated that after we pointed it out to them, they ran those 39 and found that they were not related to any lottery agents or employees. So we regard this as your real progress on the part of the lottery. I'm really appreciative of the attention given given to our audit by the director of the lottery and treasurer, Deborah Goldberg. They took this very seriously, and this is exactly what audit's supposed to do, not just call out bad behavior and try to give somebody a bad rap, but point them in directions constructively so that they can improve the integrity of their operations. So the lottery's on a good path, which is good news to all of us taxpayers.
And again, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with State Auditor Suzanne Bompa. We're talking about, right now, we're talking a little bit about an audit that was done with the Massachusetts State Lottery. Interesting that you had mentioned that they're on the right path. I mean, the monies that are brought in by the lottery, some of that money goes towards local aid. So it's
that's right.
A key proponent.
That's right. That's right. Now, they're a huge... They're a huge component of the local government revenue base.
And just another note here in the press release that I was provided, that the lottery actually did state that they're actually going to be implementing a new policy as of this month when it comes to customer service staff and record claimants, the name and all the information, correct?
Right. And that's what we want to do. We want to help people. You know, it's very easy. I completely appreciate this. I've run agencies myself. It's really easy to be so focused on one mission, one aspect of your mission, that some of the other things fall away. And that's what audits help you do. They help you focus on maybe the less urgent, but nonetheless important functions of your operation.
So we go from our conversation on the state level and talking about the lottery to talking right in the backyard here, locally, BAMSI, the Brockton Area Multi-Service Incorporated. There was an audit done in regards to what they were doing, state funds and in their inventory. Talk to us about this particular audit itself.
Sure. So the Brockton Area Multi-Services is an organization that's existed since the 70s. They are a large organization operating in a number of not just South Shore counties, but also out as far as Worcester. They are providers of services to families and children and folks with disabilities. So a wide range of services provided by this organization, which has a substantial budget. Let me tell you, it's close to $100 million, most of which comes from state government. So that means as a major government contractor that they are you're subject to audit by the state auditor's office, because we obviously want to make sure that that folks providing services are, number one, properly spending the money, and number two, delivering the services that they're contracted to provide. So we did find that there were some deficiencies. I mean, frankly, in the context of a $100 million budget, they weren't, even the dollar value was not great. Most of it came in the area of accounting, in the executive director's office, paying for things out of state funds that weren't allowable, vehicle insurance, life insurance policies, and the like. There's that financial matter. But we also look at the way they handle other aspects of their internal operations. And so we looked at their controls over their inventory. Can they account for all of the goods that they acquired? It could be appliances for some of the residences that they support in their programming. It could be computer equipment. It could be really anything. And we found that they really didn't have what we regarded as best practices and keeping track of all of that property. Because as I said, you know, a lot of it comes, is paid for with state dollars. So they indicated that they would be changing their policies. They were not tracking everything below a certain dollar amount, which frankly was a pretty substantial amount, $5,000. I mean, there are a lot of things that they were buying for less than $5,000, which to our thinking should have been tracked to make sure that that it wasn't being stolen from anybody outside or even inside the organization, and that everything was properly insured. So there was that issue. And we also took issue with the fact that some of the donations that they had received from individuals that were supposed to be dedicated to just certain purposes, or so-called restricted donations, were being mixed in with general donations, and they weren't really going to the specific purpose that the donor had to have in mind. So as I say, in the overall scheme of things, the dollar value of their deficiencies was not great, but it does, but the audit still stands for the principle that there are standards and contract provisions to which they must adhere for the benefit of their clients and also for the benefit of the taxpayers that are supporting those. And the agency was most cooperative and agreed with our findings and is taking remedial steps. So, and you know, again, that's just what we want for an audit.
And as you had mentioned, you know, the dollar amounts were small. Again, talking about $100 million that passes through that they deal with. But do you find that with a lot of different agencies and organizations that you deal with, that while they're on the right track, that everybody could always do better?
Well, by and large. On the other hand, just a few weeks ago, we issued an audit of, a human services provider in Western Massachusetts, and we found considerable financial wrongdoing out there. A lot of self-enrichment by the executive director, accumulation through some 40 different credit cards of airline travel rewards that should have gone to the benefit of the organization that he was using for personal use, and a variety of other really inappropriate uses of state funds. So, you know, sometimes the transgressions are small and sometimes they are quite large.
You know, in your, you know, nearly three terms of serving as auditor, has there ever been a case, you talk about it, you know, an instance like that where there's, you know, self-gratification using something that's an organizational type thing that should have been paid back to the organization, but yet it's personal gain. Is there something that comes to mind that, you know, during an audit you learned about a certain aspect, a way an organization was run, and you just scratch your head and you go, how did this happen? How did it go off the tracks?
You know, unfortunately, yes, I've had that. I've had that experience. And you know, not just with private organizations, but sometimes with state agencies that have boards or commissions that are supposed to be overseeing them. And it really, what's really bothersome to me is that private organizations like BAMSI and like this other service provider, they do have boards of directors. And too frequently, I think the boards of directors of these organizations don't understand that they are not there just to support the mission of the organization. You know, they're there because of the kids, or they're there because of the elderly persons that get served, or they're there because of the environment. They also have, under law, actually, a fiduciary obligation. They are supposed to be looking at finances. You know, that's part of the role of every member of every board of directors. How's the money being spent? How are we making sure that all of our resources are being properly used? It's all about the orderly administration of the organization, because those even if you're not getting state money, you still have an obligation to the people that you're servicing, the people that you're looking to for donations. And that means that you are you are always required, in fact, to ask uncomfortable questions of the executive director. And sometimes you get friendly with them. They're people that you know from the community, and you don't really want to embarrass them or cause any waves. But in fact, that is your responsibility as a board member. It's to ask those uncomfortable questions. And both the Attorney General's office and the Inspector General's office do run programs for board members to help them appreciate that this is their role, and it shouldn't be taken personally. The questions shouldn't be asked, of a personal nature and someone with some sort of vendetta or agenda other than what's good for the organization.
Talking about uncomfortable questions, it's a perfect segue. I learned prior to our conversation here that you have decided you will not seek a fourth term. What led to that decision that you did not want to, knowing that you've worked so hard to set a standard and your mission is transparency and accountability, why do you want to decide to leave office after three terms?
Well, I mean, part of the answer is in the question itself. Three terms. Right now, I'm in my 11th year. By the time my term is over in January of 2023, it will have been 12 years. I'm just as dedicated to the work of the office as I ever was. But I think that change is good. I'm very proud of what we've done. I in some respects hate to go because, the next person's going to come in and do things differently. And I, not looking forward to that, but, I do think that new ideas, can bring this organization to even higher levels of achievement. And I just want to give somebody else the chance to do that. There are a lot of talented people out there, a lot of people who really care about government accountability, who understand the role of the auditor as someone who analyzes the performance of state agencies, tries to make things better. I think there are other people that can do this job. At least I hope so.
So probably my last question. So is there a new adventure that awaits you? Is it higher office? Do we hear governor bump, president bump, or is it some other endeavor that is calling you?
No, as I stated in the letter that I sent to, that email that I sent out to some of my supporters, I am not contemplating running for a higher office.
Bump.
I still want to find a way to, further the mission of government accountability. I am sitting on a national board for a period of time beyond my term of office. I'm sure there will be other opportunities for me out there. But I'd like to just, take a little time off and see what else I might be able to do in my life.
Well, I hope that we still have a few more conversations down the road before you decide to leave office. It's been an honor and a privilege to be able to speak to you on a nearly regular basis, depending on the work in your office and award-winning team that you indeed have. Congratulations not only on the award, but also thank you for the time that we've had over the years. And, hopefully in your new endeavor, we can continue to talk.
Well, thank you. I've really appreciated all of our opportunities to get together and appreciate the indulgence of your audiences as well.
He is State Auditor Suzanne Bump. She has been our guest. Auditor, again, thank you.
Very welcome, Kevin.
We will step away just for a moment, but when we return, the final segment of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
Who have we all had a little trouble social distancing from? Here's a clue. About 6 feet tall, has handles, and is cold inside. That's right, our refrigerators. And our waistlines have suffered. However, Skechers would like to help you get back on track with our incredible Go Walk footwear. Because once you put on Skechers Go Walks, they're so comfortable you'll be inspired to get out there and start walking. Skechers is a comfort technology company, and Go Walks are fully loaded with all the comfort and performance innovations you need. They're incredibly lightweight and breathable with features like air-cooled Goga Mat insoles and bouncy foam bottoms for extra cushioning. And Go Walk footwear come in all the fits you love, like stretch fit, wide fit, relaxed fit, and arch fit with podiatrist-certified arch support. Plus, you'll look great with so many stylish options to choose from, including easy slip-ons and comfy lace-ups. And they're even machine washable. It's time you distance yourself from that fridge. Get out there and start Go Walking. Find the number one walking footwear in the world, Skechers Go Walk, for men and women at Skechers.com, a Skechers store, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. We thank you for tuning in, as I know some of you do. Maybe some of you don't, but it's okay. Fantastic way to end our program with a great guy. And I don't know, he's got one hat and he's got so many hats that he wears. We have the one and only Mike Joshua, who, as you know, yes, he is the host of Americanorama that you can hear here, I believe, on Thursday nights.
Correct. Right? 10 o'clock Thursday night.
Also, founder, executive director of Plymouth Rocks. This is a nonprofit that helps promote film and music events in and around Plymouth. Also the vice president of the Soul Homestead Educational Center.
Correct.
Also, I believe, a producer, director, and actor in The Last.
Correct.
So we'll tease and we'll talk about all the above. First, we'll start out of the gate talking about a little bit of a music series that's actually going to be kicking off later next month, June 26th, if I'm correct.
So June 26th, yep, absolutely.
And this is involving the Almost Famous Show, is that correct?
That is correct. Coming up June 26th, Soul Homestead Farm, that's in Middleborough. We're going to have a special Almost Famous night with John Shea hosting. We're going to have the Sarah Blacker Band as well as Megan Lynch performing.
How did that come together? What was the genesis of having a series? Because this isn't just going to be in June, but I believe that there's going to be a reoccurring concert every month.
Yeah, it's once a month. We actually had one in May. My Hey Blondie tribute band actually kicked off the series. So we're one in, and now we're going to have one every month, June, July, August, September, and October. And basically it came, so I'm the vice president of the board there at Soul, and obviously COVID you know, wiped out so many things for so many people, especially small nonprofits like the Soul Homestead. So all the programs went away. So a lot of the funding that we depend on to keep the farm going went away. But one thing we were able to do in 2020 was do some music programming, even though it started off very small with Abby Vail. She literally played over the internet for folks, and they were able to donate money because at that point, I think we could only have like six people at the farm or something in those dark days. But we were like, no, we can do something. So we did a show then, and then they were like, you can have 25 people. We did another show, you can have 40 people. So we were able to keep the music going at Soul, which has been happening for years and years, make a couple bucks, and then that kind of led us in to now, where, you know, it's perfect timing. Things are opening up. We can do more people. We can bring in more funds and basically get a lot of funding to the programs that needed at the farm, and music is a great way to do it.
And if you could, a mission statement of the Soul Homestead Educational Center, what are some of the things that you offer and that you do that funding is essential?
Primarily kids programming. So we would do a lot of field trips. Obviously those things went away. So when you have, you know, whatever it is, five field trips a week, you know, throughout the school year coming in, schools from all over the South Shore, South Coast, and beyond, basically just, you know, teaching kids about farming and the, you know, old time ways and gardening and soil and how things are, you know, all interconnected and why they're so important today. And we also have education programs ranging from kids all the way through adults. There's spinning classes and yarn making and rug making. Rug hooking is what they call it, and all kinds of great things for adults as well. So when you take those things away, it just makes it so hard to keep things going. And also we rent farmland, so we don't actually farm ourselves at Soul, but we lease property to farmers that do. So we have Farmer Dave Purpurov, who runs the Plymouth Farmers Market. He's our main renter. So he does all organic stuff on the farm from there, but we have all kinds of farmers there right now, coming through, five or six usually are on the slate. So it's just it's an awesome, awesome place to be.
I have to ask you, here we are, we're 2 days into the mere opening of life back up as we know it here in the Commonwealth of Mass. How jazzed are you that at least life is returning to normal, and hopefully that some of the things that we've enjoyed prior to 15 months ago can hopefully return?
Oh, I'm so ready. I'm ready. It's been a great weekend, even though the weather hasn't been great. But just to get out and know you can do stuff, and you know, just you can have your mask somewhere around just in case as needed, but you don't have to just have it, you know, riveted to your head at all times and be, you know, terrified that you're going to, you know, run into somebody and they're going to think something badly of you because you don't have your mask on yet. And you have to pull it out of your, you know, God, just, it's going to take us a little while to get out of these habits, but I'm just thrilled, thrilled.
So will there be with these performances, you know, it's funny because the governor says, well, you know, depending on your organization, your business, it's up to you. Will there be any kind of mask mandate at any of these shows? Or is it like, hey, it is what it is?
I think right now we're just coming out of the you need a mask indoors for the bathrooms and the barns and that kind of stuff. But outside, we already hit that, you know, that you don't have to wear a mask outside. So it's I think it's going to be pretty, pretty open. So we're just excited, you know, again, because we're an education program and kids, I think there's a different set of protocols for, you know, students and classes indoors and that kind of stuff. But yeah, we're just the fact that you can be on the farm grounds, walking around and not having a mask. Yahoo.
Is there a website or a way for folks to find out more information about any upcoming events that you're going to be having or anything to help financially if they want to donate?
Sure. There's a donate button on both the website and the Facebook page. So the website is soulhomestead.com, S-O-U-L-E, homestead.com. There's also a music link online. You can click there and see the music shows that are coming up, even though the only one that's on sale right now is that June 26th WATD show with the Sarah Blacker Band. And also the Facebook page, also Soul Homestead. We have an event page there that you can link for tickets as well. And there's a donate button, I believe, there also. So yeah, any way you can help the farm is fantastic, whether it's coming to a show or you know, just supporting us online, following the Facebook page, any little bit of support, we certainly appreciate.
You know, I already owe you an apology because one little detail I omitted about you and some of the things that you do so many things, is producing a really, really cool true crimes podcast. I've actually had both gentlemen on. They're on my program on a regular basis. They actually were on to kind of promote this particular podcast that they do with you. I only found out by accident that you were the producer. So I saw photos and I go, hey, I know them and I know him. And of course, what am I talking about? The Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers podcast, done by best-selling authors Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge.
Yes.
What is it like to put that together?
So that's been a lot of fun, and something that came to me new during COVID is podcast production and editing and so forth. So mudhousemedia.com, that's the company that's putting the Saints and Sinners together that I'm producing. So hats off to those guys, startup company, mudhousemedia.com. And they were like, hey, we have this new true crime show coming on with Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. And maybe they're like, maybe we could give that to you to produce. And I was like, yes, like, excellent. Let's do it. Like you said, I didn't have enough hats. I needed another hat. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And the greatest thing about those guys is that they're South Shore guys. Which I am, which we are. And, you know, if they said, oh, they're up in Gloucester, it might have been like, uh-oh. That's like the other side of the world. But no, the fact that we're all South Shore and can, you know, meet up easily and record and do all that stuff, it's been great. And those guys are just, they're awesome. Not just, you know, great writers, but great guys. And the stuff that they're talking about in these true crime podcasts, they've reported on it. They've been there. They've been on the scenes of these things. So a lot of great true crime stuff out there. But I think a lot of it is, you know, people just taking stories and, you know, kind of breathing some life into them, which is great. But these guys do that by saying, like, when I went to the courthouse, when I arrived at the murder scene, you know, when I was at the autopsy, like, it's just really, it's hard hitting stuff. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's the degree. I've listened to a couple of different true crime podcasts, and a lot of times it's kind of someone telling from a third point of view, not necessarily somebody who was the boots on the ground, somebody who was actually reporting for an outlet, but actually just somebody who's just kind of retelling the story.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's fine. And that has its place, but yep. That's why I think these guys are really ripping the lid off, because it's just so authentic. You know, again, with the Boston Strangler series that you can find at mudhousemedia.com. When Casey Sherman is talking about the story, you know, he was like, my aunt was the last victim of the Boston Strangler. I mean, that's how it starts. So who else, you know, you talk about a link, and then he has this personal journey he's had all his life, this connection to the story. And then he actually gets to go in and help bring, you know, all these new revelations, and they open up the case and all this stuff because he's directly, you know, involved as a family member, not only as a journalist. So it's pretty mind blowing.
Yeah. And the other thing is that they're very versatile in some of the stories they tell. They feel that there's different modes with these stories, and some of these stories are still evolving and still happening as we speak.
Yeah, and that's the great part about it, right? That a lot of this stuff is like the Boston Strangler case, still a big question mark. You know, they certainly arrested somebody, but did they get the right person? You'd have to listen to the podcast and find out.
Now, is there just them, besides them talking? And again, we're trying to build a scenario here, but there's more stuff that you actually are producing and adding in on some of these, where it's not just them talking, but adding other elements, right?
Oh, yeah. They have a lot of, you know, old news interviews and things that they bring in that they've, you know, collected that they can give to me to add into the stories. They wrote a book with James Patterson called The Last Days of John Lennon. Is that it? Yes, The Last Days of John Lennon. Yep. And that's what I'm working on. Literally just finished up. And those, I think part two is literally dropping today on Memorial Day for the John Lennon episodes. I mean, they went back to New York City and talked with, like, you know, Geraldo Rivera, who was a friend of John Lennon, and he was there, and witnesses that were there, and they get the actual police reports in their hands, you know, that, you know, literally blow the dust off 40 years ago and just, you know, get right back into the story. And it's really cool, the people that they bring in and just how they weave the story together.
Was there not one with Margaret Cho? Did you not do a podcast with Margaret Cho?
Yep, they do a side thing, like an unplugged Saints and Sinners that isn't exactly, you know, talking about crimes, but bringing in people who are also involved in that. And who knew that Margaret Cho is also into this true crime area. And she has her own show, I believe, also. So they reached out to her. We had her on the program. We had JP, John Payne, who's the founder of Death Row Records, on the show. Like, there's, you know, there's so many connections with people who have an interest in this stuff out there. So there's a little celebrity sideline as well.
So it isn't just necessarily one direction, as I said earlier. It's just that this is very eclectic. And I would think for you as a producer, it's got to be kind of fun where, you know, you don't know what to expect, and you know, Geraldo Rivera or Margaret Cho, whoever the individual may be, knowing that they have star power, whether they're an A-lister, B-lister, or C-lister, that it could be part of the conversation that week.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I always tell the guys that I know when the, you know, by the time the show goes up on online, I'm the one that's heard it the most. I mean, they've written it and they've recorded it, but I've, you know, sat with it for hours and hours and hours. And I'm like, so if at the end, I'm still gripped, like, or if I get a little emotional at certain points, I'm like, well, that's a good sign, because I knew it was, I knew it was happening because I put it all together. So it's a really good sign. At the end of every program, I'm just like, you know, either I get the chills or I get emotional, or I'm like, wow, this is awesome. So I know the listeners are going to dig it.
Now, that this is a little bit off script here, but they also own Fort Point Media, and they're more than just about writing books and podcasts, but like you, they're looking at possibly producing films. Is there a possibility that Mike Joshua could have a role or be able to work with that media company?
Yeah, I hope so. They definitely, I mean, they have Hollywood connections. They're always on calls with New York and Hollywood and talking about book rights and ideas and pitches. And it's kind of funny because actually Casey and Dave and myself, we still haven't had that conversation as far as my, you know, my film work and that kind of stuff, because we're just kind of so busy. But I'm sure at some point, you know, we'll sit down and I'll be like, hey, I might be able to help with that.
And that, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, is the perfect segue to talk about The Last.
The Last.
The Last. And I never knew that you were a filmmaker. I never knew that it was something that you dabbled in, that you were a writer. I mean, I know, now there's just, so folks, just a little revisionist history here. I first met Mike and his wife many, many moons ago in a bandstand in Whitman, as they were part of a band. Was it Pretendica?
Yep, Pretendica, a Pretenders tribute band.
Yeah.
That was a great gig. We think we played there two summers in a row or something, maybe 8 years ago. I don't know, 10 years ago, a while ago.
And I was the silly guy who was somehow fitting himself in that bandstand to videotape them, and pan left and pan right. And it was, you know, and again, you're a fantastic musician. Your wife is a fantastic musician. The group was really good. It was enjoyable. There's some bands that I would get up and be okay. It's not my thing, right, but they're okay. But I mean, your music, that genre, I enjoy that kind of stuff.
Awesome. Thank you.
So that's how I came to know Mike. And then, you know, it's kind of evolved from there, where he does stuff here at 95.9 WATD. And then, you know, it goes deeper. The roots go deeper and deeper. Now here I'm learning is that you're a filmmaker and that you're an actor, and you know, we're talking about The Last, which is available on Amazon Prime.
It is.
Concept of the film here is, was it a dystopian future?
Yeah, dystopian
setting.
Yep, dystopian, futuristic. Now, some might say I kind of saw the future because it's about a guy who is by himself in his bunker, and he only communicates with people via TV screens. So I think I nailed that. We have N95 masks in the film. It was a lot of fun. I just kind of, you know, went down that rabbit hole of like, you know, like a lot of sci-fi writers do, of the future and what's happening and what's, you know, what's it going to look like and who could be fighting against, you know, the corporate powers. And so I came up with the story and I wrote it to be easily shot, you know, or cheaply shot, just not a lot of locations, not a lot of, you know, just a guy in front of the TV screens and a couple other things going on. So once I had the concept, you know, I wrote it relatively quickly. And then, so this would be the third feature film that I had done. That's why I knew like, you got to keep it cheap. We don't have any money. We probably can't, you know, raise too much money. I mean, we raised a little bit, but, fortunately for myself, a good friend from Boston bartending and waitering days is my good friend Matt Stenerson, Stens as he's known in Hollywood. He's a cameraman. He's been out there since the mid-90s, kind of when I was ascending in radio at WFNX. Matty moved to LA and started his climb up the ladder as a Hollywood camera person. And he was working on, you know, he's worked on the biggest shows and from Iron Man and, you know, with Jon Favreau. And he's worked on, he was on the Christian Bale set for, what's the Christian Bale movie?
Dark Knight?
Terminator? Was he in, that's one of the Terminators? Why am I forgetting? I'm mixing things up. But anyway, he was on these biggest shows and we would always be talking. I'm like, that's so great. I'm like, we have to work together at some point. And we did a little like music video stuff together in like the early 2000s. We were able to go out to LA and shoot some videos with Maddie. But again, it was just like, that's like 1 day, 2 days and you're out. We're like, let's do a film at some point. And that's exactly what I was finally able to do. Look at the calendar and say, hey, do you have 2 weeks where we can shoot this? And he was just coming off the reboot of, forgetting all these, Star Is Born. He was on with Lady Gaga.
And oh, right.
He was literally coming off that. He had like 1 day off and then he came to help us shoot for 2 weeks in LA. And then he was nice enough to bring the entire camera package that would have cost us, you know, $100,000 to rent or something. No, he just brought that along. All we had to do was pay insurance. You know, he had lenses. He showed up with a couple crew guys who, you know, they went from like the biggest sets right in Hollywood to my partner Kurt's, you know, home in Glendale. And these guys were like, man, what's going on here? Like, look at this little set. And he was like, hey, watch it. These guys are doing it. They're making a movie. And I was like, yeah, thanks, Maddie. This is great. Thanks for the camera and all the help. And so it looks like a wonderful piece of film, which it is, because we had the top Hollywood stuff to do it in. And then, shot for 2 weeks. And then it took a couple years to put together. It's always a struggle with no money to edit and do sound and just finish the darn thing. But it's done. It's called The Last. And you can see it on Amazon Prime.
You were correct. It was Terminator Salvation.
There we go. I knew it was a Terminator movie.
No, you stalled long enough for me to look it up. So.
That's good. I like that. Yeah, he was. Remember when that's the film where Christian Bale like pulled a nutty and he like flipped out on someone and the whole thing went quiet. Maddie was on the set. He was literally there with the camera, and then he was just like waiting. You know, everyone was just waiting, looking at each other like, "What's going on?" And of course, the sound guy was still recording, which was the funniest part. But thanks to Maddie, we were able to do this film.
And again, if you're tuned in, we're speaking with Mike Joshua and talking a little bit about one of the many things that he is involved with when it comes to the arts, whether he's producing, filmmaker, organizing events to help folks who need children's programs, you name it, he's a part of it. I was going to say, is your movie kind of reminded me, do you remember the movie Rollerball?
Yes.
James Caan, and it had that corporate overlord-esque. That's what it reminded me of.
Somebody else said that. I think my brother-in-law said that when he was like, Rollerball. And I'm like, oh, that's good. Because, yeah, I love the old Heston 70s Omega Man. And, you know, some of these don't hold up terribly well. Some of them hold up quite well. You know, I remember the Planet of the Apes, you know, the ABC Friday night movie. And you'd be like, wow. You know, when you only had three channels in your world. But yeah, I love the old time sci-fi 70s stuff, and it kind of helped us out to be like, hey, we don't have a budget, so let's just keep it in that vein, have it more about the story and the actors, and just go from there.
Now, have you begun working on your next film project, or is that just something as it comes to you? It's not, you don't plan these; it has to hit you.
I have a couple scripts, obviously, that I've been writing. The last, you know, many years, and one of them, funny that you asked that, I am working it now into being a podcast and telling the story that way in different episodes, because this is just something that's starting to happen in Hollywood. I mean, some of the, you know, I think Rami Malek from, he was in the Queen movie, won the Oscar for best actor, Mr. Robot, you might know him from. Mm-hmm. He has a podcast that I'm forgetting the name of it, but I think he was like, hey, I have this thing written. I know what I want to do. I can make it a podcast like immediately, as opposed to waiting a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years for these things to come together and pitching, and you need money. And so I looked at that and I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'll just start doing that, put the story together, and then it'll be a podcast series, and then you can play it for the producer, director, money, executive, you know, the money people that you're going to need, instead of just flopping a script down in their lap, of which they have thousands already. Give them something to listen to on their drive home, and maybe they can go, oh, this is interesting. Let's talk more about this. So that's hopefully coming in the fall. Originally, I thought the summer, but as you can tell, I've got other things happening. I'm a little busy.
You do.
But yeah, that's what I'm looking at, more of doing film pitches as podcasts.
Hey, anything we want to touch upon before we go? Again, knowing that the state is opening up, where life is returning to normal. Air quotes. Anything on the horizon for Plymouth Rocks? Anything we want to tease while we have 3 or 4 minutes, or is that still in the works?
Probably just hoping for some kind of Winterfest. Again, now that everything's opened up and people are like, hey, we could do this, we could do that. But does that mean 9,000 people in the streets of Plymouth in the winter? I don't know. I'm not sure. Is that still what Winterfest looks like? So we just have to kind of look at that. One thing that we did do that we were able to do this spring into summer was the Plymouth Parklets project. We were able to raise money through a GoFundMe to build out the parking spaces where people have outdoor dining on Main Street there in Plymouth, just in time for the busy season. Obviously, right now, everyone's going to be super busy. To build out these little parklets where little decks where they can put their tables on. And we were able to do that for 3 restaurants in Plymouth. So as Plymouth Rocks, we're happy about that and looking forward like everybody to the future.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you for sharing some of your time. Again, you're a busy guy, but sharing some of the great things that you are doing here as a South Shore guy.
South Shore, hang in there. Yeah, June 26th, Soul Homestead, Sarah Blacker Band. Come on out outside. We'll have beer. We'll have local food, music. It's going to be awesome at a big 125-acre farm. So you can still have your space if that's important to you.
When you say food, is it going to be food trucks or is it going to be vendors there?
We had a vendor for the first one in May, but this time I think we are going to have a food truck here at June 26th will be a food truck, and Mayflower is going to be providing the beer, and we usually make something sweet up right at the farm for that. A Simpson Springs soda and, you know, real spring water. And so, yeah, it's a real hootenanny over there at soulhomestead.com.
Yeah, Simpson Spring, where they actually have a actual spring in the town of Easton.
Yep, and it's the real thing. It's real spring water, because some of it's not.
Mike, thank you again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.
You got it. And that's all the program that we have here, folks. Thank you again for tuning in. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.